Thank you very much, Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs. Once again, it is a great honor for me to speak under the auspices of Atid. Atid, as you know, under the leadership of Rabbi Chaim Bravender, one of the great Jewish educational visionaries of our time, and also Rabbi Sachs himself, a very thoughtful and influential leader in the field of Jewish education today. It is my third public lecture with Atid, and I'm extremely grateful once again for the opportunity. As Rabbi Sachs mentioned, tonight marks the first time that I also speak under the auspices of my new place of work, and that is Yeshiva University. I have an enormous amount of hakarat hatov, deeply, deeply grateful to President Richard Joel for inviting me to become part of his team and to help implement in very real ways his dynamic and exciting vision of bringing the values of Torah Umada that were so clearly and ably articulated by his predecessor, the current Chancellor, Dr. Norman Lamb, to bring those values to the grassroots of North America, Israel, and all over the world. To be able to educate and to inspire what I think he very creatively calls Clay Kodesh and Lay Kodesh, young men and women to take their places in the leadership in the forefront of the modern Orthodox community and beyond the modern Orthodox community in the years and the generations ahead. I want to thank Howard Weisband very, very much for his leadership bechlal in moving forward the energy and the efforts of YU here in Israel, and befrat a personal hakarat hatov to him for everything that he did to make our trip here so wonderful. And thank also to Mordechai for all of his work, and thanks to Rabbi Sachs for everything that he's done in such a classy and a professional way to put everything together as he always does so well. It is really especially a very distinct privilege and honor for me to share the podium this evening with two really master pedagogues, with Rabbanit Malka Bina, whom I've known for many, many years, who has single-handedly orchestrated a revolution in the world of Torah study for women, unbelievable and extraordinary achievement. And sometimes we wonder, what difference can one person make? We look at Rabbanit Bina and we say, what a difference one person could make. It's really an honor to be able to share the podium with her and with Rabbi Amin Goldsmith, who in the States, already as a young man, developed a wonderful and enviable reputation, highly well-deserved as a master Jewish educator. And we wish him a lot of hatzlacha here and new challenges and new opportunities as he makes Aliyah to Medinat Yisrael. The topic this evening, authority and autonomy, educational challenges in the world of personal choice. I want to frame the problem by drawing your attention to a very important book that was published 20 years ago, entitled Habits of the Heart, Individualism and Commitment in American Life. It was edited by Robert Bella and a number of others as well. My point of departure will be the situation as I understand it to exist in North America. And one of the questions that I hope the respondents will address is to what extent does this problem exist as a larger issue that needs to be addressed also within the context of the state of Israel? You look at the top of the first page after the bibliography page. If you look at the top of the first page, I'd like to read to you a little bit from Robert Bella's work. Today, religion in America is as private and diverse as New England colonial religion was public and unified. One person we interviewed has actually named her religion, she calls it her faith, after herself. This suggests the logical possibility of over 220 million American religions once, one for each one of us. Sheila Larson is a young nurse who has received a good deal of therapy and who describes her faith as Sheilaism. Quote, I believe in God. I'm not a religious fanatic. I can't remember the last time I went to church. My faith has carried me a long way. It's Sheilaism, just my own little voice.
Sheila's faith has some tenets beyond belief in God, though not many. And to finally quote my own Sheilaism, she said, "It's just to try to love yourself and be gentle with yourself, you know, I guess, to take care of each other. I think he, capital H, would want us to take care of each other." Like many others, Sheila would be willing to endorse few more specific injunctions. Sheilaism says that religion is what I want religion to be. I define my own religious commitments. I determine, and only I determine the nature of my religious behavior. For me, my name is Sheila. It's Sheilaism. Imagine what she would have named her religion if her name had been Judy. But her name was Sheila, and so it's Sheilaism. After this book was printed in 1985, it became the rage in the field of the American sociology of religion. A lot of literature was written subsequent to this book on what became known as a code word, Sheilaism. And it was a widely acknowledged phenomenon of individual autonomy and personal choice in the world of religion across American culture, and as it turns out, especially within the world of Judaism. Studies showed, articles were written, that of all religions in America, it's Judaism, it's Dafka Judaism, which more than others reflect what is called privatization. It's most subject to individual definitions by those who identify with it as their religion. More Jews than those who identify with any other religion in America decided and believed that they could be the ones who could determine what Judaism is. It's not from the outside, it's not a given, but I, as a Jew, will decide and determine myself what I define by what I call as Judaism. This is reflected in a book that was published just a couple of years ago by Steve Cohen and Arnie Eisen. We're moving on to the second entry on the first page. That's also, I think, to some extent, and I'd like to be able to see and hear from you, somewhat relevant in Israel as well. The principal authority, right, Cohen and Eisen in the introduction to their book, the principal authority for contemporary American Jews in the absence of compelling religious norms and communal loyalties has become the sovereign self. Each person now performs the labor of fashioning his or her own self, pulling together elements from the various Jewish and non-Jewish repertoires available. Rather than stepping into a, quote, inescapable framework of identity, whether it's familial, communal, or traditional, given at birth. The reality in American culture is that we choose. And if we choose, we understand that the role of authority is undermined. After all, we live in a free country, we live in a democracy, everybody's equal, and so children call their parents by their first names, students call their teachers by their first names, congregants call their rabbis by their first names, everybody's on a first name basis, because we're all the same, we're all equal. Just last week, I spoke at the GA, which is the General Assembly of all the Federations of North America in Toronto, and I was on a panel discussion, it was a plenary panel discussion, with Mr. Mort Mandel, who is the founder and the leader of the Mandel Foundation and some of the other initiatives in Jewish education, and with Dr. Ellen Shaw, who's the dean of the NYU School of Graduate School of Public Service, and myself, the three of us. And he was Mort, and she was Ellen, and I was JJ, and that was the conversation, and that's how it went. We're all the same, we're all equal, and for me to call Mort Mandel Mort, I choked on it a little bit because, after all, we're talking about somebody who I believe is an entirely different league. But that's what the culture speaks to. We're all equal. We're all the same. I call you by your first name. You call me by my first name. I could be your parent. I could be a teacher. I could be a rabbi. It doesn't matter. And in such a world, authority clearly is being challenged and undermined. But yet we understand that Judaism requires authority. For us, there are, without any question, inescapable frameworks of identity, familial, communal, traditional, given at birth. We do not believe that we have a choice to embark on our own personal journey, to take us wherever it will take us, and wherever it takes us is fine. All equally valid decisions. There's a notion of belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's a notion in the divinity of Torah. There's a notion of Mesorah, of Kavod HaRav, of Kibud Av V'Em, of Kavod HaTorah. They're given. They're not negotiable. They're not a matter of choice. All of them, and so many other aspects that we are so deeply familiar with in our own personal lives, speak to the central, foundational role of authority within our understanding of Judaism. Famous story about Chassidish Rebbe, a chassid came to him. The chassid was very upset, Nebuch, he was having a hard time. His wife wasn't feeling well, and his roof was leaking, and his horse Nebuch was schlepping afoot, and his daughter Nebuch was 14, and she wasn't married yet. So he goes to the Rebbe, Rebbe, help me, I'm in trouble, I need help. So the Rebbe listens very carefully, and the Rebbe says, you know, it's coming up to Rosh Chodesh. And after Rosh Chodesh, it's going to be Yom Tov, and another Rosh Chodesh. And you daven Hallel, you should say, Ana Hashem. You should say, Ana Hashem with Kafan. You say, Ana Hashem with Kafan, but the Rebbe Nishleil, the Mitzvah Hashem, the Rebbe Nishleil is going to help you. He goes home, he thanks the Rebbe, and he's all excited, he has a way out, he goes home, and comes Rosh Chodesh, goes to Shul, says, Hallel, Ana Hashem, and then Yom Tov, and Kafan. And Nebuch Banish of Gehof, and Nebuch, the wife is still not well, and the horse is still schlepping afoot, and the daughter is now 14 and 2 months and still not engaged. And the roof Nebuch, it goes to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe says to him, Tayyar Achusim, I told you to say Ana Hashem with Kavana, which Ana Hashem? So the chassid said, Ana Hashem Oshiyana, Ana Hashem Matzlichana, I'm being misspelled by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Rebbe says, no, it's the wrong Ana Hashem. There's another Ana Hashem in Hallel. Ana Hashem, ki ani avdecha. Did you say Ana Hashem, ki ani avdecha with kavana? That's the nekuda. That's the bottom line. Ana Hashem oshiyana. Ana Hashem atzlichana is easy. But we have to be makir. Ana Hashem, ki ani avdecha. That's the central focus of our lives. That's what we are. We're Avdei Hashem. And an Eved, by definition, means there is no choice. There is no option. There is no alternative. I'm an Eved. I'm in God's army. Finished. I have to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I believe that the Torah is divine. I believe in Ratzon HaBorei. I submit myself and my will to the authority of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ana Hashem ki ani avdecha. So how is it possible to educate to an Ana Hashem ki ani avdecha, to young people who are growing up in a culture where that's the last thing in the world that they're taught is a value. That Adarabah, the opposite, is a value. Anything but Ana Hashem ki ani avdecha. I'm not an Eved to anybody. I'm a free person. I'm living in a free country. I'll do what I want. You're not going to tell me what to do. I'm equal to you. Who are you to tell me what to do? How do you help young people understand? How do you help them accept the concept that to us is so crucial when we're fighting an uphill battle in a culture that represents everything the opposite to that? Not only does our Jewish relationship to God require authority, but also non-Jewish relationship to God. If you look at the top of the second page, we'll come back to the bottom of the first and the second. I see you asking the famous Rambam in Hilchos Melachim, at the end of Perek Ches, where the Rambam talks about the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach. The Rambam Paskins call the Kabel Sheva Mitzvos B'nizor La'asosan, Harezeh Lechaside Yom HaSa'ol. The Rambam has this concept, it's based on the Gemara, the concept of Chaside Yom HaSa'ol. The Rambam says, unlike the position taken by Christianity and other religions, in Christianity the principle is extra ecclesia, non est salus, outside of the church there is no redemption. So we don't believe that. We believe that Chassidei Umos HaOlam, even though they're not Jews, also have a chelek ma'olam haba. The who, however, says the Rambam, there's a Tanai. Shekabel osan v'yasa osan v'meshetziva ben HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'Torah. Hodiyonu al-yidei Moshe Rabbeinu shebenei noach nikonim etzalim. You know when Chassidei Umos HaOlam have a chelek ma'olam haba? and they understand and appreciate and internalize the fact that the reason why they're following the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, because the Rabbi Shloim told Moshe Rabbeinu to tell them to do so. That there was such a thing as Maimon Har Sinai, and there's such a thing as God, and there's such a person as Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's why they're doing it. They're doing it because they're accepting it from God. If they do it only on the basis of their own logic, because they're moral and decent and ethical human beings, because it's logical and rational and appropriate for them to do this, and then there's this huge tumult as to what the next word in the Rambam, the Rambam posits authority, central, not only to the Jewish concept, but the Jewish concept also of non-Jewish religion. Of course, the famous critiques of Spinoza and Mendelssohn on this Rambam, it's not fair, Mendelssohn shied the ball. Mendelssohn says just because somebody was raised in the West Indies who never heard of Jews, who never heard of Torah, why should that person be penalized? And Rabbi Yaakov Emden, in response to Moses Mendelssohn, the correspondence, tries to find a source for the Rambam. It's back and forth. But the point is that authority, from whatever perspective you want to look at it, is absolutely central to our lives as Jews. And how do we speak to that in a culture that speaks to the opposite of that? I want to go one step further in framing the question and suggest that the issue of authority is not only important for us, for B'nai Torah, B'nos Torah, for people who are engaged in mitzvot, who understand what a Torah is, but it's also important in adolescent development itself. David Elkind wrote a book, All Grown Up and No Place to Go, Teenagers in Crisis. It was published in 1984, was reprinted in the 1990s, and it's still cited in the literature today, at the bottom of page one. This has nothing to do with Ana Hashem Ki Ani Adecha. It has everything to do with the life of a teenager, the psychological makeup of a teenager. And I think it's clear that before we can address this kind of a question within the context of teenagers, we need to try to understand mitzad teenagers, how teenagers think, and how they would respond to whatever it is, whatever great genius ideas we may came up with. How would they respond? How do they react? And how would they be influenced by it? Another important marker, bottom of page one, of a teenager's place in the social order is his or her place vis-a-vis adult authority. A number of recent changes in our society, skip two lines, have undermined the authority of both parents and teachers, the two classes of adults with whom teenagers interact the most. When these adults lose their authority, parenthesis, as they have lost their authority, and he's writing this in 1984, so Kal Vachomer, then Benoshel Kal Vachomer in 2005, when these adults lose their authority, their claim to superior competence, wisdom, and authority, teenagers lose an all-important marker of their place in the social order. We need to be concerned, he says in the next paragraph, with declining adult authority in the contemporary family and school. We need to recognize its marker quality, and that it can be looked at as another way in which the society as a whole is becoming homogenized with respect to age and authority. Everybody's the same, everybody's equal. Such homogenization, thank you.
Is that better? Is that better? Is that better?
No.
It's not better, it's where it's gonna fly. It is
about it. Right, Mike.
Now it's better.
Now should keep the mic. Except what now we're good? Now we're better? Okay. I'll try my best. I apologize for the technical. Such imaginations, I don't know if I'm not saying that. Such imagination deprives, forget that. Not as bad. Such imagination deprives teenagers of still another important marker of their one special status. The concept of an adult as an authority figure is crucial for the development of a teenager and an adolescent. So the problem is, how can we make this happen? And our problem is compounded, not just out of concern for the development of a teenager and an adolescent, but we have a job to do. We have to transmit what we believe is the most important thing in the world. And how do we do it when we're facing such an uphill battle? I want to suggest one possible approach, one hawl to this issue, that may begin to tackle the problem. It's very much for me a work in progress, and I'm really very much looking forward to the comments of my fellow distinguished and honored panelists and the audience as well. I want to try to look at this issue from two perspectives. From the authority figure, herself or himself, namely from the perspective of the teacher, and second, from the perspective of the content of the tradition, or the mesora that's being taught by that teacher. If you will, a kind of a gavra cheftza perspective. The gavra, the authority, and the cheftza, the object, the content of what's being taught. Now I want to begin with the cheftza. 30 years ago, Jerome Carlin and Saul Mendelowitz wrote an article that dealt with the decline of authority in the American rabbinate. I've not seen this article. I actually just serendipitously fell on it last week when I was reading an article by Professor David Ellenson of HUC on the struggle that Rav Israel Hildesheimer had himself in 19th century Germany with the issue of diminishing rabbinic authority at that time. So they talk about what's going on in America 30 years ago, the notion of the fact that the rabbi just ain't got what the rabbi used to have. And in this article, they come up with two terms that I would like to begin to use this evening. They talk about in the middle of page 2, we're back to the middle of page 2, after the Rambam and Hilchos Melacha, they talk about imperative authority and influential authority. Imperative authority is characterized by the possibility of applying organized, relatively specific sanctions, which include use of coercion. Influential authority, which by hortatory and exemplary conduct involves the imposition of unorganized and diffuse sanctions. I would prefer to take out the word imposition and to take out the word sanction from influential authority. So you have imperative authority or coercive authority, and then you have authority that's not forced on you, but there's an influence. It's sort of a softer kind of an authority. It's still authority, but it's a softer authority. But the notion of imperative or coercive authority reminds me of the famous Gemara in Masechet Shabbos. The Gemara says right below, Pechas Amad Aleph, Ha'is Yatzvu, B'tachtes Ha'har. What does B'tachtes Ha'har mean? So Rashi says, B'tachtes Ha'har, Tachas Ha'har Mamish. Tachtis means, the way the Gemara interprets it to me, did the mic go off? The mic went off. Now it's on. B'tachtes Ha'har means literally Tachas Ha'har, under the mountain, Tachas Ha'har Mamish. What does it mean, under the mountain? So you're all familiar with the famous Gemara, the Sefer Shabbos, Amar Abavdini, Barchama, Barchasa, Melamech HaKofa, Kodesh Baruch Hu, Aleim, Esa'ar, Yigis, Amar Lehen, Matem, Bekav, Lematora, Muto, Vemav, Shantei, Furasa. The ultimate Gemara of religious authority, of coercive, or what they call here, imperative authority. And Israel is under the mountain, we're standing by Kabbalah Satorah. No, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to them, you want to be Mekabel the Torah? That's great. But if not, what's the alternative? Rather coercive. In fact, the Gemara says, Yikamo Dor Rabba Lo Reisa, the Gemara answers, King of the Kidlu. The Gemara itself recognizes that it's a rather coercive authority. It's interesting to note two words here in this text. Number one is Shom, the hate for us. And number two is the image of Kigigis. What is Kigigis? So Rashi says, it's kind of a battle. So my father told me many years ago that maybe the Shem means his followers. Maybe what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling the Israel is not, you accept the Torah, great, and if not, I'm dropping the mountain on you, and you're going to die right here, because then what should it have said? Oh, the hateful Rasha, not Shem. But what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling them was that if you accept the Torah, that's great. If you don't accept the Torah, you live. You'll exist for a little while. 100 years, 200 years. But ultimately, Shem, In the distant future, the Tvach Aroch down the line shall take Kurasa. When was the last time you met a Chivi and a Yavusi and a Girgashi and a Chiti? They're gone. And that's what would happen to you also. And that Pshat Kigigis, what does it mean, Kigigis, a barrel? Under the barrel. That means they were in the barrel. What does it mean to be in the barrel? They were surrounded by the barrel. The image is if you take a glass and you put it on an insect. You put a glass over an insect so it will flutter for a little while. But soon the air is going to run out. And the insect is going to die. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said. But however you understand the concept of Kafa Lehem Har Kigigis, the Amar Lehem, the Matem, the Kabbalah, the Satar, Mutav, and La, Shantek, Furasim, and talking here about an element of coercion. Contrast this to the beautiful, beautiful Medrash on the next page, on the top right of the next page. The Medrash is so warm. The Medrash is so, in fact, such a delicious, wonderful Medrash. The Medrash has the same image of being under the mountain. The Tachna Sahar, top right, page 3, Melame, Shenitla, Shahar, Mimakomo, the Korvu, the Amdu, Tachtov, Shenema, as the Pasuk Tachna says later on. Not just Tachnis, but Vatikruvim, Vatandu, Tachasahar. Well, what's the Tzushtel? What's the image? What's the significance? What's the resonance in the Medrash of the image of being under the mountain? Alein, the Furash, the Kabbalah, Yerlati, the Chadvei Asala. My dog is in the cleft of the rock. Why is my dog in the cleft of the rock? Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu pick up the mountain over them? Because they're never in the desert. It's hot in the desert. They're schwitzing. They're uncomfortable. They want to be mekabel the Torah. They're so busy worrying about that they're dripping from sweat. They can't concentrate. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu envelops them. HaKadosh Baruch Hu protects them. HaKadosh Baruch Hu picks up the same mountain and they're standing under the same mountain, but the image is not an image of coercion. It's an image of protection. It's a loving embrace. What a different way of looking at the same thing. It seems to me that it would be helpful for teachers to be able to present not a coercive element of Torah in today's world and in today's culture. Maybe there were times in Jewish history when it was appropriate, when people were more misundal to that, when the culture allowed for that. But today it seems to me it would be more helpful, more appropriate, to present not the Gemara and Shabbos image, the Gemara and Shabbos interpretation of the image, but rather the Medrash of warm and loving and embracing and protecting nature of Torah. That the Chefetz of Torah, although it has authority behind it, and we believe that without a second, that the Chetz of Torah is not something to be imposed, but rather to be stressed, is the varmkeit, and the warmth, and the beauty, and the protection, and the all-embracing, and the enveloping, and the caring, and the closeness. The varmkeit of Torah and mitzvahs. And Soloveitchik delivered a hesped for his lachetels, the Talmud Rebbetzin. If you look at the bottom left of the third page, the Machatanis of the Talmud Rebbetzin, the mother of my late teacher, Professor Tversky, she passed away. The Rav was Masbiter, and then a year or two later, it was printed in a special issue of Tradition that was devoted to a series of articles by the Rav Zatzal. I believe I quoted this in the last lecture that I gave for Atid, and I want to come back to it from the perspective that we look at it this evening. He talks here about the role of the Jewish mother. On the left of the third page, I admit I'm not able to define precisely the Masoretic role of the Jewish mother. Only by circumscription, I hope to be able to explain it. Permit me to draw upon my own experiences. I used to have long conversations with my mother. It was a monologue, a dialogue. She talked, I listened. What did she talk about? Must use our halachic term. She talked, Mayin Yom HaDiyum. I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her davening. I used to see her reciting the Sedra. I remember the two, and I learned from her very much. Most of all, I learned from my mother. The Rav who one Yortzeit Shir rattled off 23 Misachas that he learned with his father. His father was his Rebbe Mover. Most of all, from my mother, I learned that Judaism expresses itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there's a flavor, a scent, a warmth, a varmkeit to mitzvahs. it's easier for students to be open to be Avdei Hashem. It's easier for students to internalize the truth of Ana Hashem Ki Ani Avdecha. It's easier for students to accept upon themselves the O Malcha Shamayim. And O is a very strong and hard word in today's culture. It's easier for students to be bound by what they will accept to be the Ratzon HaBoreh, when they can be exposed to the flavor and to the scent and to the warmth and to the barakah of mitzvahs. And part of why I think this is so is because in this realm, the students feel that there's room for autonomy. Because in this realm, in the realm of the barakah, students feel that there's room for individualism, that there's room for personal inclination, for personal choice, for the sense of self, for what makes me, me, be able to express itself. I bring myself to this dimension of Judaism. I define, and my definition could be very different than yours, I define the flavor and the scent and the warmth of mitzvahs, and I define them in terms that resonate with me. I can bring, or I can exercise autonomy within the great big world of authority. We also quoted last time from my late teacher, Professor Tversky, his article in Religion and Law on the top left of page 3. The Penn's dialectical relationship, wrote my teacher, Professor Tversky, the Penn's dialectical relationship between religion and essence and religion and manifestation is at the core of the Jewish religious consciousness. Professor Tversky borrows from a term first used by a Dutch scholar some 10 years before this article was written, a Dutch Gentile scholar, and Professor Tversky uses it to understand what is Judaism all about. And Judaism is about the relationship between religion and essence. Judaism is all about the relationship between religion in essence and religion in manifestation. What is religion in manifestation? Religion in manifestation, as described by Professor Tversky, is the given, is the proscribed, is the prescribed, is the scripted, is the maisa hamitzvah, the chol pratel v'diktukel, where there is no room for individual expression. I have to light the Shabbos candles on Friday night, and I have to light them in a particular way. And normally I make the bracha before I do the Maisa Mitzvah, but this time for various reasons, I first do the Maisa Mitzvah, I light it, then I make the bracha, but in order to cover that, so I have to cover my eyes, there's a whole process, and I have to take the match and put it in a certain place. There's a whole ritual, there's a whole tekes that goes into lighting Shabbos candles. I eat the matzah, the Leila Sefer, so I have certain kazes, and I have certain minutes. And I eat a Be'er Seva, and I'm chewing, and I'm chewing, and I'm chewing, and I'm looking at the clock, and I'm chewing, and I have another Zayis, and another Zayis, chewing, and I'm swallowing, and I'm lying, I'm mamish, I'm doing the mitzvah, the chol, protavitah, okay? You look at me from the outside, you know exactly what I'm doing. Come Sukkot, not too long ago, I take the Arba Minin, and this is in this hand, and this is in this hand, and this is the pitum up, and the pitum down, and I put it together, and I shake it, I eat, and I air, and I'll recite it. It's exactly scripted, prescribed exactly what I'm supposed to do. That's religion in manifestation. What's religion in essence? Religion in essence is the varmkeit, is the warmth, is the resonance that that mitzvah has for me. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to be robots, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to be monkeys. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to be transformed by the mitzvah. So what am I thinking about? What am I feeling? What is transforming me? What is transporting me when I'm eating the matzah, or when I'm shaking the lulav, or when I'm lighting Shabbos candles? How is it affecting me? It's very personal. It's very subjective. It's the opposite of scripting. I bring myself into religion in essence as I conform to the outward script of religion and manifestation. And I think that in religion in essence, there's tremendous room for autonomy. It's my feelings. It's my experience. It's what I bring to what I do when I take the Arba Minin. It's not all scripted. Autonomy of religion, in essence, operates within the authority of religion and manifestation. Now, I think this is really a crucial point, and I think I'm trying to chip away. Rabbi Sacks said earlier, it's not authority versus autonomy. I'm trying to come up with some kind of a middle ground, acknowledging the value, the absolute value of authority, and acknowledging the reality of autonomy, to try to come up with some way that these two could be bridged, to figure out worlds of autonomy within the concept of authority. It's very important for me, but it's hard. I'm teaching now at Sterling College for Women at Yeshiva University. And I taught my students this quote by Professor Tversky and also the quote by the Rav. And I gave them an example. I said, take Lulav and Esri. So Lulav and Esri got Raminim, so the religion of manifestation is to take it and to shake it and to hold it and to fit them and to bracha. It's exactly the way it says in the Shulchan Aruch, that's what you have to do. So what's a religion in essence? What is it that I'm bringing? What is it that's making me different than a monkey or a robot that can do the same shuffle or rye and the same shtick and the same movement? What makes me different? So there's a religion in essence. What's the religion in essence? Nusson is a medrash that says that the Arba Minim each represent a different kind of a Jew. And this has Tam and Reach, and this has only Tam, and then this, and then both, neither. And they are of a Jew, and this Jew, and what we do, we bring them all together. Nusson, when you're holding the Arba Minim, you're thinking about Achdus Yisrael. You're thinking about Achdus Yisrael, how wonderful Klal Yisrael is. That it's not pshat that if I left out the Arava, I was Mekayim three quarters of the mitzvah. The pshat is if I left out the Arava, I was Mekayim nothing. That without the Arava, Jew Nebuch, the whole mitzvah is Mishkan mitzvah. So what does that mean about my responsibility for Klal Yisrael? Such a beautiful religion in essence. And then the religion in essence about the Nanuim. The Nanuim, I shake it to Abba Ruchas Ol, I'm up and down. Because I understand the natural world, and I understand HaKadosh Baruch, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is all over, and I connect HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's a spiritual moment for me. I'm not just out shuffling a Langa Lux show with a thing and a little round thing. I have a service when I take Arba Minim, because it speaks to me. And then I said, now let me give you another example. I said to them, let's say you're an art major. Let's say you appreciate aesthetics. Maybe you could come up with something that makes significance of the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't just say take a lulav and esrei. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says take something green and take something yellow and put yellow next to green. So there's a din in the color. And let's say you appreciate somehow the combination of yellow and green to you is a remarkable combination. And because you know art and you studied and you know pigments and you understand, you see, you experience, you have an aesthetic soul. So the green and the yellow transport you. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what a world that's so fantastic. And you become closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the godless of the yellow and the green. So that's your religion in essence, and it's wonderful. So two girls raised their hands, our 41 students. Two girls raised their hands and said, is there a medrash that talks about the yellow and the green? So I said, I don't think so, I don't know. But let's say there isn't such a medrash. So they said, if there isn't such a medrash, then it's not an authentic religion in essence. That religion in essence, in order to be authentic, has to be rooted in the text. And I tried to say, and this is a great conversation, go on for hours, maybe it doesn't have to be rooted in the text. Maybe it's rooted in your neshama. Who said that that also has to be scripted? It's enough that the religion of manifestation is scripted. Adarabba, I'm looking inside. I'm looking in myself to my own being. What do I bring to this mitzvah? I bring myself with everything that I am, with all my experiences, everything that I'm exposed to, all my art classes. I was zeicher to have art classes. So I appreciate green and yellow. So I think that that's important, that it's dafka not scripted. And maybe it's dafka not a medrash. If it's a medrash, let's say it's not a medrash. How can we try to explore avenues of autonomy, of myself, of my being, of my identity, of my kishkes? What do I bring to the religion of manifestation, to the Ratzon HaBorei, to the Shulchan Aruch, to divine law, to Torah, and to mitzvahs? On the last page, I xeroxed for you from the Shulchan Aruch about tefillah. Tefillah is probably, anybody who's been involved in day school education, and I would dare say anybody who's tried to daven with kavana more than 7 times, is probably one of the most difficult things that we have to engage in. How many times can you say Asher and really think about it, and it should really transform? How many minchas do we say that I'm different after the mincha than before the mincha? I daven mincha, great! I did mincha, great! So I did mincha, wonderful! But now, am I any different after mincha? So maybe it's kedai at the bottom of page 6 to try to stress the notion in Ratzel Lahosev, Echol Brachos Me'em Tzoy Yosmeid Abrachom Hosev. Maybe it's kedai to talk to students about Sholom HaMetzrachom Hishomei HaTfilah. Again, I'm trying to look for examples within the Matbeya Shel Tfilah, within the text of the Tfilah we have to say. We can't just have religion in essence, we close our eyes, we hum, and we think we hum, we hum, and I feel close to God, and I'm finished. I have to say the words. No, I have to say the words. I have to say the words. That's a given, I don't have a choice. But maybe there's a way, even within the context of the given, of the scripted, of the religion of manifestation, here in the context of tefillah, to try to figure out ways how to be able to create a world with some modicum of autonomy as well. I want to just spend mamish a few minutes in conclusion talking about also the teacher. Not only the chafetza of Judaism, to create within the world of the chafetza of Judaism room for the student who is bombarded with the value of I-ness, to be able to feel that Torah and mitzvahs is not opposite of that. That's the reality that we're living in. It's not a mila. It's not good. It's a reality. It's a challenge for us. How do we deal with that? Our hands are tied behind our backs before we start. But also to think about the role of the teacher. The teacher is an authority. So the Gemara says on the top of page 6 that, of course, we have to stand for a teacher. Of course the teacher is an authority. A teacher is part of the Shalshalas HaKabbalah. A teacher is the one who transmits the Mesorah. Kama Tipshoi Shar Inchi Dekaimei Nekame Sefer Torah. The Gemara at the end of Matis, top of page 6, Huokame Nekame Gavar Rabba. But also teachers need to understand and soft pedal, it seems to me, would be appropriate and helpful to soft pedal themselves as the ultimate arbiters or the icons of authority. Erica Brown wrote an article for the Torah Manga Journal a while ago, the bottom right page 3, and I think with this I will conclude because I really want to leave time for the conversation. That a teacher needs also not to present herself or himself as the epitome of perfection. That it's important to convey that a teacher, a couple of lines down, is not a completed, perfect being, but is still himself or herself part of a learning community. Role models who are not afraid to show their own struggles are no less role models. They may, in fact, show the student a good deal more about personal growth. The end, instead of self-confident sense of arrival, the teacher can present character education as a process or a journey which she herself or he himself is still engaged in and to which the teacher invites the student to join. The invitation to be part of this process can cut the form of an enriching diagonal line upon which both student and teacher find themselves rather than the vertical ascension of the student to the height of the teacher. It's not that the teacher is on top. The teacher is the oracle of wisdom and perfection and absolute authority, and the student is below, and the teacher pours forth into the open mouth and the open mind of the student who simply makabal whatever it is that the great holy teacher is going to teach them. But the teacher herself or himself is also strong. The teacher herself or himself is also doubting. Doubting significant, not down to Chas v'Shalom, belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The next page has the whole story about Avraham's doubt on the way to the Arkega. But doubting, I don't understand why God does certain things. I don't have all the answers. I'm struggling with you. Maybe at one point I struggled and now I have answers. Maybe even now I'm struggling. To somehow not present oneself as a teacher, as the absolute, total pinnacle of full authority and perfection, because the student won't be comfortable. The student won't resonate with that. That's alien. It's totally alien. rather than imperative authority, to be influential authority. Doesn't mean that the student should call the parent by his first name, but it means there's a hierarchy. But it's not Kirachot Mizrach Mimayr, but there's a connection and there's a relationship and there's a sense of humanity in the teacher as well. So not just the Chafta of Torah, I believe, should allow, and maybe we need to explore more the autonomy within the Chafta of Torah, but also the Gavra of Torah, to allow for more autonomy, for more personal. That it's not a cookie-cutter Judaism and every teacher is the same. That every teacher has their own atheists and their own derech and their own approaches and their own struggles. And to some extent, I think teachers struggle with this all the time. How much can I bring my student into my own life and into my own struggle? But maybe to some extent, a shtickle, an epic, something might be worthwhile so that the student doesn't get the idea that the teacher thinks that she or he is the greatest, the most important, because that's simply going to be so difficult for the student to be able to incorporate. So what I'm trying to say is that there's room for autonomy in the world of authority, and maybe this notion might be helpful. It might be helpful to our students as they grow up in 21st century Israel and 21st century America, struggling, our kids are really struggling to negotiate their places or their identities as B'nai Torah or B'nos Torah. And it's very difficult and complex and challenging, larger world in which we live.